From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Near Eastridge.
Sunset.
Eastside, San Francisco.
Border of Venus.
San Jose.
Coming up, the story of how a black comedian and a white cafe owner turned a tough situation into a teachable moment.
This is so Berkeley. They're going to have a talk about a racist thing that happened. You're damn right, all right?
This is so Berkeley.
Then we hear how California's foster youth are being prescribed psychiatric drugs at alarming rates.
We talked to one public health nurse who found a group home where the teenagers were being put to bed at 8 o'clock and diagnosed with insomnia so they could justify sleep meds.
We're going beyond the headlines today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. If you walk into a Bay Area Starbucks this week, you may get more than just a cup of coffee. The chain has been running a campaign to foster conversations about race. It's called Race Together.
Baristas are now free to write Race Together on the company's coffee cups to begin a dialogue with customers about race relations.
At a Starbucks set amongst the big box stores of Emeryville over the weekend, some of the cups featured a Race Together sticker, though servers weren't bringing up the topic in conversation. The whole concept brought mixed reaction from the customers. Crystal Pratt thinks it's a good thing.
I think we often shy away from conversations about race for fear of sounding racist or biased, but I think a lot can be learned from just talking to each other and educating each other about our differences and, you know, being in a positive way instead of it always having to come as an aftermath of some horrible racist event.
Emily Carter feels a little less sure about the timing.
I would have been comfortable talking about it, but I don't know if when I'm at Starbucks I really want to have a long, meaningful conversation with the barista.
Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz says the first phase of the Race Together campaign is over. That's the interactivity. But he wants to continue fostering dialogue about racial divides at his coffee shops around the country. Now, those coffee shop conversations aren't limited to Starbucks at all. In fact, one was spurred by a racially charged incident at Berkeley's Elmwood Cafe. After comedian and TV star W. Kamau Bell was told to leave the brunch spot, he helped organize a forum designed to open up a conversation about race and racism that happens under the surface. About 300 people attended the event at Berkeley's Willard Middle School, including KALW's Sandhya Dirks. She brought back this story.
So to talk about this story on a somewhat colorblind medium like radio, I'm going to have to spell out race. Melissa Hudson Bell is white, and her husband, W. Kamau Bell, is black. The day the incident happened was Kamau Bell's birthday, and the family went to the Elmwood Cafe in Berkeley to celebrate. It was a happy family outing, with their three-month-old in tow. After eating, the couple left to do their own thing. Hudson Bell ended up back at the Elmwood Cafe with a mommy group she was just getting to know. So her husband, Kamau Bell, stopped by the Elmwood again to say hi to his wife and her new friends.
And he walked up to where we were sitting at the table, and I quickly introduced him to the women that I was with who had only just found out he was a comedian.
Not just a comedian, but a famous comedian. Bell had a show on the FX network, totally biased. And yes, Bell deals with race a lot in his comedy, like in the segment Anything to Say to a Black Guy, in which Bell, playing the black guy, asked white people if they had anything they wanted to say to him.
Anything to say to a black guy.
I've always just wondered what it feels like to walk around as a black man. Do people avert their eyes?
Either they avert their eyes or they really stare.
One of the two.
One of the problems with being black is that sometimes when people are mean to you, you don't know if they're being racist or just being an ass.
Yeah.
I would appreciate if white people, when they were mean to black people, would say, this is racism. Ah, now I'm just being a dick.
I think that's why we have the N-word.
That's true.
This clip is resonant because the joke Bell is making is that sometimes racism can be coded or disguised. which is exactly what the Bells say happened to them on that Monday at the Elmwood Cafe when Kamau Bell returned to meet up with his wife and her new friends. Melissa Hudson Bell picks up the story.
He'd probably been standing there 2 minutes maybe saying hello, and there was a kind of rapping sound on the window behind me. I thought what I often think, like, oh man, I can't take him out anywhere. People are recognizing him because he's famous. And I looked at him in his face and quickly realized, oh no, that's not what this is.
It was a different look, a look equally familiar to her. Not the look of people knowing him, but the look of him knowing he's been told he doesn't belong.
And it was really clear from the expression on his face, like, oh, he's being asked to leave.
People of color, I'll say it now, experience what is called microaggressions or implicit bias all the time, every day, all the time.
And that's Kamau Bell. And here we get into the language that's been developed to talk about race, which is part of what this forum is all about. So here's the gist. According to the panel, a microaggression is basically an underhanded compliment that conceals a racist stereotype. Like saying to your black friend, wow, you don't act black. These seemingly harmless moments, they accumulate and people internalize them. It's a way of hiding stereotypes in everyday life.
But the problem is we can't talk about it all the time because we would sound crazy. And this incident was so blatant. I was like, I can't let this one go.
And he didn't let it go. Neither did his wife, Melissa Hudson Bell. She says the waitress apologized, but it just kind of made things worse.
She continued to say, I'm sorry, but then said the thing that I really don't care for, which is, I really don't think that it was a race thing. And I said to her, it absolutely has everything to do with race.
So the Bells co-authored a blog post. And because Kamau Bell is famous, it went viral, which is how the Elmwood Cafe's owner, Michael Pierce, heard about the incident.
I was deeply upset by it. And I got really upset. I called him and I told him how sorry I was that this happened.
It was that conversation that led Pierce and the Bells to want to talk through the incident in a public forum to discuss what it really means when a black man who stops to talk to his white wife and her white friends gets shooed away from a restaurant in the heart of liberal Berkeley. Pierce says he quickly recognized how the incident at his cafe made him feel.
I think the feeling I felt was shame. I think that's the best way to put it.
At the forum, audience members write down anonymous questions on index cards, and moderator Harrison Small reads them aloud. One question addressed the emotion that Pierce felt, shame.
How do you think we can talk about racism and microaggressions without shaming people?
Well, shame can be a moving emotion.
That's Nikki Jones, a panelist tonight, and an associate professor at Berkeley. And here's Kamau Bell chiming in.
Can I just say, what's wrong with shame? Sometimes you should feel bad.
All right, this question is for Kamau. What made you so sure it was a racially motivated act as opposed to one directed towards you for other reasons, such as the large homeless population that solicited the cafe?
I love this question. Thank you. I know it was racism. I know it was racism. You can listen to me and we can talk about it and discuss. And at that moment, I think somebody, as they said down here, then you go, oh, what can I do to stop this? What can I do to help you with this? The minute you go to, I don't think it was racism, and you're not a person of color from that community, you've just lost a friend.
And there were more questions from the crowd, honest questions, with sometimes uncomfortable responses, like with this question, again, read by moderator Harrison Small.
As a white person, woman, going into a black space, clubs, cafes, neighborhoods, I have also been made to feel unsafe. that I don't belong. How do we all become colorblind and treat each other as just human beings?
Khadija Means has a response to that question. Means is the head of the Black Student Union at Berkeley High. And she says colorblindness, that really isn't the goal of all of this.
I think that you need to stop trying to erase color because you think it's rude to mention someone's race, or it's rude that, like, I don't know. That's just ridiculous to me. I'm sorry. It's hard for me to articulate that. Please don't call people articulate. Don't come up to me after and tell me I'm articulate. Oh, God. Woo! Please do not do that.
Calling a Black person articulate, she says, that's microaggression 101. The panel ran on longer and later into the evening than planned, but people stayed, including the TV news trucks parked outside. Kamau Bell had a request for the crowd. Don't let the media define this event as a one-off.
They're going to report on this that they had this event and the event happened. And at the end, they're going to talk to you as you walk outside and feel free to talk to them. They're going to get some clip of somebody going, I thought it was good. I thought it was bad. I don't know. And that's going to be the story, allegedly.
As a member of the media, my first response was to go get those sound bites, the sum it all up moment, the nicely packaged event tied up with a bow, even to sort of dismiss it because the forum happened in Berkeley, what some might call the politically correct capital of America. But Bell, he basically called me out on that, too.
I've seen some people online. I saw people say, like a news report, this is so Berkeley. They're going to have a talk about a racist thing that happened. You're damn right, all right? Hashtag this is so Berkeley. Please take this out there into the streets. It's not about the Elmwood Cafe. It's not about what bad thing happened to our family. This is about, we're all here because this has happened to all of us, or we want to know, learn more about it. Take it into the streets. This is so Berkeley. Thank you.
And that's the hope, to take the conversation to corners where people might not throw around phrases like implicit bias and microaggression, to feel comfortable about calling people out when they do something they might not realize is racist, to not be embarrassed, to have embarrassing conversations. In Berkeley, I'm Sandhya Dirks for Cross Currents.
One way the conversation about race in Berkeley is moving forward is with a new training program for service industry workers. Michael Pierce is working with Race Forward on a curriculum, he says, he'll implement at the Elmwood, and he hopes to take it to other establishments. Pierce says he's soliciting community response, so you can email him at info@implicitbiastraining.com. Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Now over to the South Bay, where a different type of discussion will be happening this Thursday night at the Tech Museum in San Jose. The Bay Area News Group is screening a documentary as part of its latest investigation into the overprescription of drugs in California's foster care system. The state has almost 60,000 foster youth, and one of every four is given psychotropic drugs. Drugs to fix their behavior, not to help a mental illness. Drugs known to have horrible side effects. San Jose Mercury News reporter Karen DeSa spoke with many former foster children for the investigative series Drugging Our Kids. She came by our studios earlier this week to talk about what she discovered.
Even more alarming was that of those kids on meds, of all children on meds, more than half, significantly more than half, were receiving antipsychotic medications. This is not your run-of-the-mill Adderall or ADD drug. These are really powerful, mind-altering antipsychotic medications that are approved only to treat severe cases of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, some forms of autism, but those are extremely rare in children. The concern about antipsychotics in particular is that they're used for behavior management. They're used on kids who are very, very sad and depressed, and even more significantly, I'd say, used for kids who are aggressive, who are really angry about their circumstances and frustrated, and so they act out in difficult ways for their caregivers. So they're being used to essentially sedate the children.
We're going to hear from a number of the former foster youth that you were able to interview as part of this project, Drugging Our Kids, and we will put a link to it as well online. But that takes me to hear from Mark Estrada, who talks about how he felt that this was, you know, used as a restraint or a punishment, or when he wanted to talk, he would be drugged. Let's listen to the clip.
The combination of the Vyvanse and the Seroquel together made it much so a chemical restraint for me, and it was a restraint to keep me quiet as they didn't want me vocalizing my concerns and advocating for myself.
And so that's Mark Estrada from the project Drugging Our Kids. With me is the reporter on that project from the San Jose Mercury News, Karen DeSa. And so Mark was talking about, you know, basically them using these drugs to quiet him or to keep him at bay. Did you find this was common?
He came into foster care as a teenager, as, you know, almost 18. He was physically abused at home by a parent. And he went to a children's shelter. He said he was fine with the Vyvanse, which was his ADD meds that he said helped him concentrate and do better in school. But when he got to the children's shelter, they added Seroquel, which is an antipsychotic. And he said that he was pissed off and angry and frustrated because they weren't letting him see his brother. And for a lot of kids in foster care, when they're acting out, there's actually a real reason behind their behavior, and they feel that no one listens to them. And instead, they just kind of get doped.
Okay, so let's hear from another youth that was interviewed for this project, Drugging Our Kids. And her name is Rochelle Trottenberg. So let's hear what Rochelle said.
You know, it sucks when you're like 15 and putting on makeup or brushing your teeth seems like climbing a mountain. And on psychotropic drugs, sometimes that's how it felt. I just felt like my brain was disconnected from my body, and everything felt like a mental exercise to overcome those side effects.
That's the voice of Rochelle Trottenberg, one of the young people, former foster children who are featured as part of the reporting project Drugging Our Kids from the San Jose Mercury News, Bay Area News Group. And the reporter on that is Karen DeSa, who is with me here in studio. So Karen, tell me more about Rochelle and about these side effects that these youth were facing.
So Rochelle experienced many of the side effects which are quite common and quite documented, particularly with the antipsychotics. And those are rapid onset weight gain, tremors, which she still suffers from 10 years after going off the medications. Her hands shake really bad sometimes. Rochelle is someone who has been able to live through this experience and then come through it quite valiantly. She finally connected with a therapist who really helped her with her abusive past, the abuse of the foster care system, which is bouncing her from dozens of homes and group homes, and helping her to, now she has a very powerful voice. She's part of a statewide expert panel advocating for solutions in Sacramento pretty much as we speak.
And so can you just tell me kind of the structure, the clinical structure of how these meds get prescribed? Who is there in the foster child's life, and how does it work?
It's really different in for every child and in every county. Some counties have county-employed clinicians who treat the kids. Some counties, like Alameda and Contra Costa, contract with private medication clinics where literally their contract is to see a child and, if they deem appropriate, put them on medications. A lot of those appointments are brief and perfunctory. The kids are not necessarily offered alternatives to the medications. Another concerning practice is a lot of group homes have individual private contracts with their own psychiatrists. So there's a psychiatrist on contract with a group home to serve their needs. And the concern about these medications as chemical restraints is that it's in the facility's interest to keep the kids under control. I mean, we talked to one public health nurse who found a group home where the teenagers were being put to bed at 8 o'clock and diagnosed with insomnia so they could justify sleep meds. So when you have a psychiatrist working with an institution in that way, there's a lot of concern about conflict of interest.
Let's hear a clip from another youth that you featured in the reporting. Her name is Joy Mara Coleman, and let's hear from her.
I was pressured a lot to take the medication. There were times where I felt like if I didn't take the medication, I would be disappointing my therapist or I'd be disappointing my social worker because they really advocated for me to take the medicine. They were really adamant about that. And so when I didn't take it, I kind of felt like, you know, I'm letting them down because I'm being combative. And, you know, when I did take it, I felt like I was pleasing them. But at the same time, I wasn't really, you know, acknowledging the fact that it was making me feel like crap.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. And that is the voice of Joy Mara Coleman, one of the former foster youth featured in the reporting series Drugging Our Kids from the San Jose Mercury News. The reporter is with me in studio, Karen Desa. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So we just heard from Joy Mara Coleman, and like hearing that makes me feel like there's this special relationship between her and her social worker, that she doesn't want to disappoint her social worker. And that's why she takes all these medicines. And she even, you know, she doesn't tell her that it makes her feel like crap. What in that relationship adds to all of this, this dilemma?
I think the first thing is when a doctor tells you this is going to make you feel better, and you're really depressed and you're really angry, and you think, I want to feel better. Joy Mara didn't know to be suspicious. And if you don't have your social worker on your side, who do you trust? That's the person who is placing you in supposedly a safe and lasting home.
And lastly, what do you want people to take away from this reporting?
I think that there are lessons in this reporting for everyone in society, because I think that these young people are kind of the bellwether. We as a society are increasingly subject to the marketing whims of the pharmaceutical industry. And I think if any of us with children in elementary school were to find out how many kids were on ADD meds, for instance, how many of us as middle-aged women maybe were quick to get a prescription for an antidepressant versus some other type of non-pharmaceutical intervention. I think that we all have the potential to encounter an excessive use of psychiatric meds, and I think that we need to all pay attention to this.
That was San Jose Mercury News reporter Karen Desa, who investigated the prescription of psychotropic drugs in the foster care system. Colin Peden helped produce that interview. The documentary and discussion will take place tomorrow night at the Tech Museum in San Jose at 6 o'clock. It's free and open to the public, and Desa will be facilitating the conversation. More at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. If you have a suggestion for a story we should cover, let us know about it. Email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW or call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio.
Our team includes Leela Day, Jack Detch, Rachel Dornhelm, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hambrick, Angela Johnston, Marcy Fraser, Ted Muldoon, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Audrey Dilling. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Bay Area Latin reggae fusion band Rucatan Latin Tribe. They're celebrating their fifth anniversary together on Friday night at the Club Fox in Redwood City. Show starts at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.